Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star 1 on your touch-tone phone to ask a question. I would now like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I'd now like to turn the conference over to Jim Brunzel. Thank you. You may begin.
All set to go? Okay. All right. Thank you, everyone. I think we're all set to get started. So first of all, thank you, everyone, for coming to today's NSF SIZE Distinguished Lecture. It's our great pleasure to have with us today Helen Nissenbaum from NYU. What we normally do when we do introductions is, first of all, my name is Jim Carosa. I'm the assistant director here in the Directorate of Computer and Information Science and Engineering. I think I know everybody here, and hi to folks who are outside and watching us on the web. What we often do when we do the introductions is the assistant director or division director does introductions, and it would be my pleasure to do that today because actually as a PI when I was at the University of Massachusetts in the Future Internet Architecture Program, I had the privilege of working with Helen and other PIs on that and her work there on ethics and user-centered design. But rather than me introduce Helen, I wanted to ask Susie Iacono, our former deputy assistant director who now leads the Office of Integrative Activities and who's been a longtime friend and colleague of Helen. I'd like to invite Susie up to do the introductions. So thank you, Susie.
And thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to join Jim in welcoming you all here for this distinguished lecture, and I think I have some kind of SIZE emeritus status or something, so I'm allowed to actually do that. But I'm here to introduce today's distinguished lecturer, Helen Nissenbaum. She's professor of media, culture, and communication, and also of computer science at NYU. She has a PhD in philosophy. Computer science, but this is an important point. Keep this in mind. So Helen and I have known each other from at least the year 2000, around that time. So this was when I first came to NSF. I was a program director in SIZE, and the name of my program was Digital Society and Technologies, and Helen was then at the Center for Human Values at Princeton. And I, in preparing these remarks, I thought back about those times, and what I remember is being at least 100 workshops together with Helen. So you need to understand historically this is a very fertile time for socio-technical understandings of our world. So the internet, right, had just been commercialized. The World Wide Web had just become available. New collaboration technologies were just being used. I mean, it was a brand new world. And it had been dominated, really, by the technical folks, by the computer scientists, the people building the technologies. But we were really intent on building a new field, bringing together researchers from both computer science and social science. And believe me, in the beginning, the two did not understand what each other were talking about. I think we're much better today at doing that, but just the language that was used, the word policy, for example, for a legal scholar meant the law, right? You know, the legal law that's written down on the books. A computer scientist, when you're talking about policies, you're thinking about the policies that are embedded in the software that are helping the software to run. So it was really a tremendous amount of work, which is why we had these hundreds of workshops and conferences and meetings. It was so important to us, I think, to bring these communities together and to really fashion this kind of new way of thinking, this new socio-technical understanding. And I remember being so excited by the approach that Helen brought to this. was very proactive. And so she was saying, let's think about values in design. So instead of designing these artifacts, and then after we throw them over the fence, people start using them, and we say, oh, woe is me. My privacy is being violated. They're surveilling me. They're doing all kinds of bad things. I don't like the fact that I don't have choices in the search engine. Why would we wait until after we've designed the technologies to think those thoughts, to think about the impact? Why don't we design in human values to begin with? Right? So this was a very important, different way of thinking about how technologies fit in the world with us. So I brought some artifacts from those days, and one of them is called Grow a Game Card. So enclosed is one deck of premium quality game design cards for your thinking and playing pleasure. Use alone or in a group. For best results, mix rules vigorously with creativity. Okay, so I remember Helen coming into my office so excited. Look, Susie, look, this card game. And that's because she was working very hard on thinking about how you design computer games, online games, so that, for example, maybe women and girls might be interested in playing them. Right, and so this game was supposed to help us brainstorm, think about different values, think about how we might want to design games with these new human values in mind. Another artifact, that was 2008. This is from 2012. So the title in The Atlantic says, "The philosopher whose fingerprints are all over the FTC's new approach to privacy," right? So there are many products that she has developed over the years, including software. One was called Track Me Not. Another is called Ad Nauseam. And so I'm making a very important point here. You're all looking at me very quizzically, right? This is not an ivory tower philosopher. She, yes, is writing many, many, many articles, and she's written many, many books on these topics, but she's actually implementing her ideas and talking about her ideas and trying to get us to actually think about and use these new approaches. This is just so important, I think. And I think that that's really Helen's most important contribution. And I think you will realize it today after you hear her talk, is that she has this incredible ability to help us think more clearly about very complicated socio-technical phenomenon. And so it's these new ways of thinking, it's these new, more proactive approaches that really help us to deal with the world we live in. Please join me in welcoming Helen up here to the podium, Contextual Integrity at the Intersection of Ethics and Technology.
Thank you so much for that introduction. I was a little nervous that Susie was going to talk about some of the other things we did at the almost 100 workshops. But anyway, it's been amazing to have all these conversations with Susie, and thank you, much exaggerated, but thank you very much. This is a huge honor to talk in this particular series. And I have to say, and I feel like I'm going to have tears in my eyes when I say it, is that my professional development has everything to do with the National Science Foundation, because when I graduated with my PhD in philosophy and I started getting interested in these issues relating to, call it what you will, digital technology, computation, information technology, all the different names that we use, it just wasn't a field exactly, and there weren't so many people who were talking to computer scientists and being philosophers at the same time. But it was through very early grants and Rochelle Hollander, who was in the Ethics and Value Studies program at the time, who said, yes, you know, these are important issues, and this is something that the National Science Foundation should support. And it's this kind of vision, I think, that has really enabled, and I'll put myself in the category, but I think there are many other researchers and investigators who've been able to flourish, although they may not have easily flourished within the university disciplinary environment. So it's really a special honor to be here. And here are some of the grants that I'm calling research grants. There have been some other grants that have supported PhD students and workshops and so forth. And I will talk, I'll try to mention them specifically as I perform the overview. I want to, overall, what I'm going to do is talk about two lines of work, kind of parallel tracks of work that I've been doing in the past number of years. One is devoted to privacy, and the other one, which Susie mentioned, values in design. In some sense, the privacy work you could think of as a subset of values in design, because privacy is a value, but it happens to be an incredibly important value in relation to information technology, digital media, and so on. And I have to confess that I was so excited about giving this talk that I just threw everything in, and I don't know how long it's going to take me to get through it, but, you know, if I'm taking too long, I'm just going to cut out stuff, and I'm going to try and do as much as possible. I'm a little bit worried. Ooh. Will you just give me a sec, because I may have opened up the wrong version of this talk. Sorry about this. This is how excited I was. You know, maybe can I unplug? Forgive me for this little glitch. Okay, yeah, this now is good. All right. Okay, good. So, what has been stimulating to me as a philosopher, and I'm in a way paraphrasing Brian Pfaffenberger, who's an anthropologist at the University of Virginia. It's not so much that I come in as an ethicist or I come in as a philosopher and I look at the science and technology and I say, okay, I'm bringing to you certain ethical concepts and this is how to reason about them and here are some theories. What I believe is happening is that technology has become such an important way of organizing society that philosophers, or those of us in the social sciences, social theory, we cannot utilize the same concepts and theories that have evolved over many years, many centuries, because technology presents situations and challenges that have never confronted people before. That they're similar types of problems, and in that presentation of new problems, we, meaning the philosophical and social scientific community, must evolve our concepts. And so being a philosopher is really being a philosopher of technology and having and seeing how the concepts that philosophers may have been discussing on their own actually have to change when in the confrontation of the new problems that science and technology present to us, and the field that I, as you've heard, have mainly been looking at has been digital technology, information technology, computation, and so on. So here is the slide of the two tracks, and here let me just quickly talk about the outline of the work. What I'm going to do is quickly talk about these ideas of values in design that you heard Susie quickly describe, and in particular a framework that I developed with Mary Flanagan along with the Grow Game card called Values at Play. And then just a little bit more generally about some of the specific projects in that line of work in values in design. Then I'm going to, and that will hopefully be take not too much time. And then the main part of the talk is going to be contextual integrity, which is the definition or the conception of privacy that I've developed over the years, and now trying to see it in application to things like policy, ethics, society, technology, and talk about some of the problems that I think contextual integrity can help us solve, but also there's a lot more work to do, and some comments about what I see like on the horizon, and I like to think over the rainbow, but who knows. So, focusing now on the values in design part of the track, and here is some of the work that I've done over the years. Maybe you kind of get the recipe, but I've put circles because often when you talk about values, people think, oh, you know, morality, and it sounds very conservative. Not that that's a problem, but there's some concern about this imposition of morals when you use the word values. But I use the word values in ways that I think many of us would be comfortable with, to talk about, say, fairness and justice and public good and accountability, trust, security, which although it is a characteristic of a computer system, it also is a human value. And some of this work has been very formative to my thinking. For example, in the work with Bastia Friedman, where we looked at bias in computer systems, we foreshadowed some of the concerns that have become very important in the area of big data, ideas of big data and discrimination and fairness. What Bastia Friedman and I tried to do is, first of all, offer an operational definition of bias as systematic unfairness, and then, again, following what Susie was saying, it's not so much to say, oh, take this system, oh, look, it discriminates against certain people, but rather to say, let's delve into the workings of the system, let's examine this algorithm and understand why certain parties are being disadvantaged in the operation of this particular model or this particular system. And then we looked at things like the medical match algorithm and airline reservation system. In the work on accountability, in the work on politics of search engines, what's that? Oh, I just, Lucas and Krona and I looked at search engine results and argued that some of the algorithms underlying search engines unfairly discriminated against certain sites above others. And what you can see here in the, I'm not going to go through everything, is that the work, this work was in collaboration with many amazing collaborators, and the collaborators were legal scholars, they were computer scientists, they were social scientists, and so on. Now, over the years, I've come to understand a few things about values in technology, just insights that have evolved over the course of performing a number of these studies and trying to understand what it means to talk about values in technology. One thing that in thinking about privacy, we realized that actually technology covers a lot of different things, and to do a study of values in technology, you could be talking about a technique like crypto. It could be talking about architecture, system architecture, some little widget, some tool, or a mechanism, a technical system, and so forth. And ultimately, and so this is just an observation, that if you're looking at values in design work, it could be about these different objects. And there are a few essential characteristics of values in design that I'm eager to point out. One is that the ethical values, it is important to understand that these ethical values emerge from the technologies in their functioning, so they relate to technical characteristics, but the values emerge as a combined function of the technical characteristics and the functioning within particular human social settings. And again, you know, it's always looking back. With Batya Friedman, we tried to characterize different kinds of bias in computer systems, and we noticed that some biases only emerge when you take a particular system and then you situate it in a different community. So, you know, back to video games, back to games, is if a game is developed and it's utilized in an all-male environment, then you don't see the bias. You take the same game, you put it in a co-ed environment, suddenly that the game starts discriminating, but you don't see that until you place that technology in an environment. And that taught me this lesson, which I think I hope I'll get to in the time that I have, and that is that when you're thinking about any kind of value embodied in technology, it's really crucial to look at the technology in detail, but also to be thinking about the environment in which that technology is going to exist, because sometimes the values actually emerge. It's like the chemistry of that technical system embedded in a very particular environment. Now, I think that security, the security community has tried to capture and make rigorous that concept with the notion of a threat model. And in values in technology, we can work with that idea in trying to understand the relationship of the technology and the surrounding environment. Second sort of essential insight is that values in design is actually quite a radical idea when it comes down to it. What it's saying is that you can take an artifact that you can describe in fully technical terms and also observe certain regularities in the technical characteristics with certain outcomes. So it certainly makes technological determinism not sound so stupid as it always does when people talk about it, because in fact what the technological determinist is saying is that here we have the social world and we describe the social environment and the ethical environment, and here we have technological characteristics, systems, and so forth. And they're separate. They move by two different logics, never shall meet. But the values and design community is saying, no, there are ways in which it makes sense to look at these two together because there are regularities. And what this means, in my view, is that those of us like myself and other social behavioral scientists and so on, we're in it together. We cannot do our work without pairing with scientists and technologists. And I want to think that those scientists and technologists who are interested in seeing the relevance of the work to these issues are eager to be in communication because, as I say, this particular observation puts us in this together. Now, as Susie mentioned, one of the things that was happening, so the studies that I showed you a little bit earlier were mainly performed as, let's look at the search engines. This was just at the time Google was emerging and the algorithms had been published and we were doing a study of that. And so, or the bias in computer systems, we looked at existing systems in use. And accountability, we were looking at, I was looking at, when certain machines fail and what happens with accountability when so much of life is mediated. And I think with robotics and machine learning, we're, you know, these issues have gotten quite huge. So, but we started to say, if there are values in design, if you can think about technology in this way, what about thinking about technology in this way before the system has been created? And that was the motivation behind Values at Play with Mary Flanagan, and we were very fortunate to be awarded a Science of Design Award And with that Science of Design Award, we created the Grow Game cards, and we built many. I say we built many games because we were a collaboration. But in truth, it was Mary who created the games, and I played at them a little bit and so on. But it was that kind of partnership in which we developed many games. We developed certain curricula for games designers. And one of the things that I was quite involved in, and even though it was developed with games in mind, I consider incredibly useful in thinking about values in technology, and it's the values at play framework. So I want to just dwell for a few minutes on it to say that the values at play framework identifies three components in the design activity. One is discovery, and that is, you know, what values are should we be paying attention to? What values are implicated in this particular artifact? Second, where do the values come from, and how do we define them in operational terms? So it's all very well for me to say to you, oh, just go read that article on privacy, but for someone who's actually building something, you need the definition in operational terms. And the second component is implementation. This really, so the first falls on the shoulders mainly of the social behavioral scientists, and I think this is really where philosophers have something to offer. The second falls mainly on the shoulders on the technical person in a team, because you have to take this, say, security, you have to take this concept defined operationally and translate it into, as designers always do, take a functional description and then translate them into features and architecture and widgets and whatever it is that's being created. And then the third component is verification, and this often will fall to the social behavioral scientists, but also to the technologists to ask that question of, did it work? Did what we try to do work? And we emphasize that this was not about doing, do this first, do this second, but rather it was an iterative process. So that's where I'm going to leave values at play and now move to talking about privacy, and I'll come back, draw attention back to values in design, values at play towards the end. So everybody in the room, I expect you have diverse backgrounds and you understand how just the waves and waves of technology emerge, and they have had dramatic impacts on our sense of privacy. And many have stimulated this idea of, oh my God, my privacy is being violated, what can we do about it? Oh, I'm sorry, this is the slide I thought you were looking at. And in the book, Privacy in Context and in the Development of Contextual Integrity, I just try to simplify the picture by saying that a lot, if you look at some of those complaints, those concerns about privacy, what you'll see is that many of them emerge as a result of the implementation or the deployment of certain kinds of technologies that have a disruptive impact on the flow of information, some in the realm of collecting information, monitoring, surveillance, some in the realm, and this was even back in the day, more so even today, aggregation of information and analysis, data mining, and so on. And then, of course, communications networks, just the web and web 2.0 and now, of course, mobile, and we're also advancing into the arena of Internet of Things. Now, maybe for many of us, when we decide we're going into a problem, it's because there was some particular thing that really bugged at us. And for me, what was getting to me about privacy back in early 2000 was this problem of privacy in public. And as you see, actually late 1990s, was that people were upset about the fact that little bits and pieces of information could be captured about them in public places and could be combined and we could do all this stuff. And yet the series of privacy and the policy of relating to privacy didn't see that as a privacy problem. And so this is an indication you have a problem, you have resources, policy resources or philosophical resources, and those resources can't meet the challenge. And that's when I first of all recognized and called this the problem of privacy in public, showing why certain theories don't solve the problem of privacy in public, and out of that grew the theory of contextual integrity. And what I want to do today is actually go through the theory, just as a quick show of hands. Has anybody heard of the theory of contextual privacy as contextual integrity? Okay. Well, you're now an interesting test case for me. The theory of privacy as contextual integrity is an approach to thinking about privacy in a certain way. If I said to you, for example, well, what is the definition of privacy? And you said, privacy, okay, I'm going to say this, and then, I don't know, you might have to be honest with me and ask the next question. Privacy is about controlling information about yourself. How many people was that on the tip of their tongue? Okay, so I mean that's one of the dominant theories of privacy. I would love to actually go around the room and say, well, what is your definition? But then I really won't make any progress. But contextual integrity offered a view of privacy, because things that people said just annoyed me. So one of the things people said is, oh, people don't care about privacy anymore. They say they care, but then they post all this stuff on Facebook. And I'm thinking, yeah, that does not mean they don't care about privacy. And so I'm going to describe contextual integrity in a series of four, and I think they're independent theses. And each time I present one of the theses to you, I'm going to show how contextual integrity differs from some of the other views of privacy that predominate at the moment. So the first claim of contextual integrity is that when people complain about privacy and say, oh, my privacy's been violated, they're complaining about appropriateness. So it's not that people don't want anybody to have any information about them. What we want is that information should flow appropriately. Flow is an important part of the thesis, because it's saying that when we protect privacy, we're not stopping the flow. Now, I can tell you countless computer science papers, and probably many in my field too, will instantly say that a leak of information is a privacy violation. Any information gets out, that's a violation of your privacy. So number one, when you say privacy is appropriate flow, then you're saying that some flow of information is fine, but some isn't. So it's not pure leakage, it's not placing the information or telling people something, it's about appropriateness. Of course you're saying, what the heck is appropriateness? And that's number two. The claim here is that appropriate flow is conformance with the thing that I call contextual informational norms. So it means that and many of them are entrenched informational norms. What we're saying is that and the word contextual became important because I started thinking about some of the prime examples, the paradigmatic examples, and wanting to present the notion that we don't live in undifferentiated space, that much of our interactions are contextual. I mean, academic environment, I'm in a healthcare environment or context, I'm with friends and family, I'm in a religious context, political citizenship, and so on. and that the informational norms that guide us are contextually based in that regard, and they're substantive. This puts me at odds with many approaches to privacy, and this is a big one. So FIPS, by the way, is Fair Information Practice Principles. This dominates in the world, and I suppose I'm going to go down in flames, but this is an enormous problem because this means for many of the standard interpretations of Fair Information Practice Principles, this is a purely procedural approach to defending privacy. It's not willing. So out of that, for example, and I'm cutting so many corners here, I'll, you know, forgive experts who might be tearing their hair out, but this idea of informed consent is procedural in that it says, and it's related to this notion of privacy of control, well, I want to do something with the information about you, you know, I want to sell your information to a data broker. Do you agree? And if you say yes, then I can do that. So it's not about whether the flow to data brokers is a good thing or a bad thing, which is the presentation of substantive norm. It's about we have to jump through these hoops, we have to follow these procedures, and that's going to tell us whether privacy has been respected. The third is a proposition about the structure of these contextual informational norms. And I offered five parameters. So a norm is a privacy norm or contextual informational norm, spelled out in all its glory. You have to specify values for five parameters: actors, subject, sender, recipient, the type of information, and then this transmission principle. What are the constraints under which information flows? So the subject control, this is in direct contradiction with that. There are some theories of privacy that like to divide the world of information into two buckets, private and public, and then the rules follow if it's private information, but with public information, pretty much anything goes. So contextual integrity, it cuts against that. I've observed in many works on, say, access control rules, is that some of them will claim to be protecting privacy, but they're not specifying all the parameters. So they may say, what do you think about the disclosure of this information, of, let's say, your health information? But they don't say to whom. They just don't say that. They just say disclosure. Now, if you don't specify that all the five norms, then my argument is, this is not a privacy rule. It's some other rule, but it's not a privacy rule. And just in case it's not like embedded in your mind, I want to say that this is something when you go home tonight and you're having bad dreams, you're going to be saying, all the parameters matter, all the parameters matter, because all the parameters matter. Now, here are just a few of intuitive informational norms which I consider to be appropriate flows of information. I'm not going to read everything, but just let's look at the one about the citizen of the U.S., and then you'll see. A citizen of the U.S., that's the data subject, and, by the way, the sender. So often the sender and the data subject are the same, is obliged to reveal gross income to the IRS, the IRS recipient. Gross income is the information type, under conditions of confidentiality except as required by law. So, obliged under conditions of confidentiality except as required by law, that is the transmission principle. Those are the terms under which this information flows. So, here are the informational norms, just to kind of reinforce the actor sender, and this is always acting in capacity, physician, merchant, etc. What are the different kinds of information types? And here are some transmission principles. So consent now is one transmission principle among many. It can be like from the Fourth Amendment, with a warrant. It can be surreptitiously. It can be with notice. there'd probably be an unending number of transmission principles. And here's another way, here's another example of how we look at the information flows. So Equifax provides Daisy White's credit report to Wells Fargo Bank with authorization from Daisy White. So that is a well-formed informational rule. And in early work, and this is work under the Porsche grant, which was a cyber trust large grant, which changed my life literally, when John Mitchell at the time had heard me talk about contextual, an early version of contextual integrity, he says, you know what, I think we can express this formally. We have formal language and logic, and this idea of the norm, the way you've presented it, we can do it. And so this is the formal rendering of it in that paper, which I'm not expert enough to go into it in detail, but we took that and then we looked at some existing rules in the law book, and we were able to show that in some cases the way the law is written conforms precisely with the structure of the informational norm. Now, so far so good, but what I've presented thus far is just the descriptive theory. I haven't said anything about its ethical weight. We know that when we introduce information technologies, they're disruptive flows, and some of them are actually hugely beneficial. You know, we have medical devices which have disrupted the flow, changed the flow. Nobody's saying this is a problem. There are many kinds of surveillance technologies that we can welcome. As we all know, I'm wildly enthusiastic about these applications of information technology and digital media. But there are certain applications which are problematic. And the question is, if you have a theory of privacy that you want to carry some ethical weight, you want to explore why certain flows, certain practices are problematic and others not, you need to be able to say why certain practices or why certain norms are legitimate, are ethically legitimate, and why others are not. And this is what gives contextual integrity its ethical dimension. So none of us will look at, say, the rule that governs the physician's confidentiality towards patients and say, that's just a convention. We want to say that this is an important commitment that carries ethical weight. That is to say, physician confidentiality. And that was my responsibility in making contextual integrity carry ethical weight. So the theory of contextual integrity will argue that in deciding about certain flows, and particularly remember we said about disruption, we have a disruptive flow. Mark Zuckerberg makes a decision about how Facebook is going to distribute information. It's not just a matter of deciding, this is going to be the design. What we have, and the proposition in the theory is to say we have to take into consideration three things. One is the interests and preferences of the affected parties, that you can call those parties stakeholders, kind of economic approach to thinking about this. And there's a lot of work, I'd say a lot of policy work is in this vein. Second of all, we want to think about ethical and political principles and values, and there's a large body of really excellent work on privacy that looks at ways in which privacy protects speech rights, it protects autonomy, it sometimes protects us against unfair discrimination, and so on. So we look at these ethical and political principles and values. And I built on top of these observations, but then contextual integrity adds this third aspect, which is And here I drew a lot from Chris Regan, who had already really beautifully presented this idea of privacy not only as in the interest of the individual, but it's a social value. And I expanded that to talk about contextual functions, purposes, and values. When we think about, for example, democratic citizenship, we might ask the question, why is your vote secret? Why should democratic citizens vote secretly? You may say, well, and this is one approach to thinking about privacy, it's going to protect individuals so that we vote freely without fearing embarrassment, repercussions from. But that's not where contextual integrity stops. Contextual integrity goes one step further and says, when we're thinking about democratic citizenship, the value in this context, one of the values is democracy. And democracy is grounded on the idea of by the people, for the people, every individual eligible to vote votes what they believe in. And the outcome of that is what democracy is. And if it was anything different, we would lose democracy. And so what privacy protects is not only the individual in this case, but it's the integrity of that institution, of that value. And these similar arguments we've tried to make in other contexts as well, for example, education, in healthcare, and all over to explain why privacy is a value not only for individuals but also for society. And here are just some rough ideas. And I always love to give this example, which is, you may not know this, but in the early 20th century, very early, your IRS records were public, and Andrew Mellon came along and said, you know, we really need to make these records secret and confidential. Why? Because otherwise rich people are not going to declare, and therefore the Treasury is going to suffer. So it wasn't only about, oh, let's, you know, spare people embarrassment, protect them against harm. It was like the Treasury is going to suffer if rich people don't declare and we don't earn as much money. So that was very contextual thinking well before its time. Here's a summary of the four steps: appropriate flow, conformance with norms, the structure of the norms, and all the parameters matter, and then the ethical legitimacy of privacy norms based on these three different criteria. Now, kind of coming up to the present to say contextual integrity, I'm confident in its capacity to address many questions, but there's no doubt that there's certain soft spots into it that I need to shore up, and there we kind of need to test its mettle. And some of the claims, and I think philosophers are notorious for making empirical claims with absolutely no empirical justification. And I've been working in interdisciplinary settings for long enough to know that I really needed to do some work on this. And so I have a lot of, I have a bunch of more slides, and I'm realizing, I don't know, I'm not sure how long you'll stay. I think 3:30 is like the drop dead end of this session. So I'm going to be very quick about it. So there's three areas in which I've been doing some work. And when I say I, it's not really me. It's me and other people who have made major contributions to this. So I'm just going to talk about we. In the area of developing some of the ethical conceptual tools and seeing how contextual integrity can help to address certain policy issues, in the green are things that have actually happened, and in the lilac color are issues that are really open and I believe need work. So, of course, we're very proud of this, which is the White House Consumer Internet Privacy Bill of Rights, which was published in February 2012, Respect for Context, which says that consumers have a right to expect that companies will collect, use, and disclose personal data in a way that is consistent with context. And so that was really a fabulous thing to happen. And we've performed certain kinds of pretty detailed analyses, applications to actual policy questions. So, for example, should we post court records online? You may say, what's the conundrum? This is a public record. But it turns out there's a lot of private information, and a record sitting in a filing cabinet somewhere is very different from the record posted on the open web. And we're confronting, I mean, open data, the principle of open data has become quite big. Obama has welcomed it. Many local government agencies have welcomed and subscribed to it. But a lot of those records also contain personal information, and the question is, what do you post and under what conditions? And I think that contextual integrity has some insights to offer on that, and work I've done on privacy online also tries to say online is not another world. Online is most online interactions can be situated within social context, and we should acknowledge that. And so should organizations acknowledge that in their policies and practices. I've been doing some work in this area of social science and social theory, in particular looked at some ongoing work with Kirsten Martin, where we try to argue that a lot of work that survey work, you know, one should really re-examine a whole lot of survey work, but in particular, we were interested in looking at the survey work that was conducted by the Pew Foundation, which found consistently that people ranked certain kinds of information on scales of more sensitive, less sensitive. The reason this is an important finding is that often law and policy gets developed based on the ranking. So certain information is considered sensitive, we're more likely to be able to generate law surrounding sensitive rather than information that might be considered not so sensitive. So what we wanted to show is, remember the five parameters, that if, in fact, what's going on is that if you regulate based on one parameter only, which is information type, and then you reduce it into two buckets, public and private, you actually, the confounding variables at play that are going to make what you do wrong, if you care about what people think about it, that is. And so what we did in this study and is that we took these particular categories of information. We were able, on Mechanical Turk, with I think we had 600 respondents, replicate the results of the Pew study with that to get the same kind of ranking. And then we presented the respondents with a bunch of vignettes in which we said information about these attributes is collected by, and we called it a contextual actor, for certain uses, and we said contextual or non-contextual. So it might be the doctor collects information about your health in order to improve diagnoses or something, versus the doctor collects the information in order to sell to a data broker. That would be considered non-contextual. And then we find this, that when you add those variables, you get wide alterations in people's judgments, so that information that they judge pretty not so sensitive, actually, if it's given to a non-contextual actor or even a contextual actor but for a non-contextual use, people don't like that at all, even if it's not so sensitive. It was sensitive information, and you may say, oh, that's obvious. They were plus 70 on the, yeah, that's expected when it's medical information to the doctor, but of course, you know, if it's in the workplace, they were very unhappy about it and so forth. So for me, this was an interesting way to test how adding the right parameters into the mix is going to get you much more finely tuned results. The last bit of the talk is really in science and engineering, and in particular values, in particular the privacy by design, which I'm delighted to see has become, has really caught on at the moment in technical and policy circles. There have been a number of ongoing workshops, and we have we come back to values at play, and we can see that what contextual integrity actually is the definition of privacy in operational terms, which can be more easily utilized in the translation of privacy into design. And this is going to be way more complicated than I can manage, but at the moment I'm working with 8 colleagues on an effort to absorb certain content and message metadata, be able to extract the automatically extract the contextual parameters, send it on to a norm checker that will be able to say, yes, this particular flow either adheres to the norm or it violates the norm, and then out pops some kind of recommendation. Don't send the message, or yes, it's okay to send the message or that information. This is ongoing work, and it's tremendously difficult, but it's also an interesting, this is one of the most interesting things is, where do those privacy norms or the privacy rules come from? And here we have endless debate among the tech and non-tech members of the group. We did some Mechanical Turk studies, and you could see that there were some that people agreed, there was high levels of agreement. We thought, oh, this indicates the norm. And there were some more complex cases where it was not clear what to do with the results. this is ongoing work, as you can imagine. My technical colleagues much prefer to have an oracle and ground truth, but we cannot always offer that to them. Anyway, here are some of the science and engineering efforts going on. This, I have to say, I left it to last, but this is the part that I tend to be most excited about, which is this this issue that I described at the beginning, which is the effort to take ethical concepts, ethical constructs, and put them, place them on top of technical artifacts, and be able to observe or analyze the artifacts or the design decision and say, you know, if you make this choice in the way you design your system, that is going to discriminate, or that is going to open up privacy issues. And just to give you another small example, if you build a language that doesn't have 5 placeholders, you're not going to express the rules with 5 parameters, and you're going to have rules that, from the contextual integrity perspective, are ambiguous. So on the horizon, I went online, I wanted pictures of horizon, so here you have some beautiful, I thought this would be a fun thing to do when everybody's tired. Aren't these nice? Anyway, future directions, these are questions that some of them I've started thinking about. These are questions I would like other people to think about, because they could make contextual integrity more useful. They could point out some of the errors in contextual integrity. I think that big data is a challenge to contextual integrity, because anything based on information type is going to be a challenge for anybody in the realm of big data data mining. On the other hand, because some of the problems with contextual integrity is too many moving parts, or the feature space too big because of the 5 parameters rather than just a 2, for example, I'm actually hopeful that some of the techniques from big data and machine learning can be helpful in stipulating a solution space in terms of contextual integrity. Thank you very much. Thank you for hanging in.
Yeah, yeah. So I think somebody's going to hype a little bit. Three, but I think we have time for some questions.
Yeah.
So, you mentioned bias possibly emerging.
Yes.
Obviously, you want to be able to predict that that could happen before you do it.
Yeah.
But you know, let's suppose you can't predict it. Do you have means of sort of detecting it or measuring it after, just shortly after you deploy it into the environment and see it happening? Is there a way to see it, detect it, so that you can then do something about that?
If
you,
right.
Is there a way to,
You know, I mean, I'm just saying what other people, I don't have specific insight into it. The way in that particular case, the game that was created with boys in mind and then was taken to a co-ed was just people went in and studied. They just decided, oh, we're going to study this, and then they discover that. But bias is notoriously difficult because this recent generation of data mining, the point of it is to construct discrimination, is to perform discrimination, to identify the bases upon which to discriminate among some parties and other parties. So the bias can be of various different kinds. One could be that society, it can come from society. They can just be the wrong criteria for making decisions, and then we embed it into the system. So there's some pre-existing bias. Second of all, we may go in with all the right intentions and then find the system that we designed is. But to capture the discrimination, sometimes it's very obvious, as we've seen with people who have done studies like who's getting the mortgages, and then we find that, oh, these minority communities are doing much less well, or job postings. And we've seen some interesting work, but it's difficult. It might need to be case by case. And there's some work that tries to apply, like Cynthia Walk tries to fairness through awareness. There's some work in that area. Yeah.
Just to follow up on that question, couldn't you look at the game or whatever it means and look at the interactions that take place in the game and sort of code them and sort of extract what the bias might be and apply those, you know, five principles?
Yes. I mean, absolutely. It's more just if you're in a very big and complex situation and maybe you hadn't even decided to look for it, but it's there. And because the system is designed not in the game, because that's different. The game in particular was there to teach kids grammar or something. But in the cases where it's let's utilize data mining, machine learning to select this employee out of a batch of applicants, then you are using it to draw discrimination to identify, and then it's much harder to do it, but we know this is a discussion that's decidedly important. Yeah?
Well, this is a practical question that will require a little bit of philosophical preparation. First of all, I'm an admirer of your work.
Thank you.
As a one-time but abandoned philosophy major, I've read some ethics and things like that a lot. Must admit that it was Nietzsche's work that was very dubious of ethics that most impressed me. Indeed, notions like values within the social sciences are controversial, but fit into universalistic theories of ethics, that there must be rules that apply to everybody, which fits a democratic government that has to develop policies that do not offend the democratic public. On the other hand, my personal first contact with advanced computing in the middle 1950s was visiting my uncle's computational linguistics lab in Britain.
Yeah.
And he had been at Bletchley Park.
Yeah.
And From him, I learned the notion of computation as conflict, as competition between enemies and allies. And my practical question, if I can articulate it, is why are we at NSF not seeing proposals, however well or poorly we review them, that look at, for example, hackers' behavior? That wouldn't look at Snowden because we wouldn't have the power to do it, or maybe could look at WikiLeaks. We've got no criminology program here. But in the mid-1960s, and we seem to be going back to that kind of cultural format, people like Barry Schwartz were writing particularistic theories of ethics, and indeed specifically of privacy, that your group was in conflict with all other groups. And so privacy and intimacy were linked. Whatever the value of any of these approaches, do you know from your contact with many people why we're not receiving proposals that are seeking to understand better the sources of conflict through computers?
Gosh, I can't answer the question you ask. And I'll reduce it to something. I'll be like a politician. I'm going to answer the question I can answer. But I think it's still relevant to what you say. One of the issues that comes up again and again in privacy, and it might have been on the slides, but I didn't mention it in my comments, is that privacy is very culturally specific. And in particular, they'll say, you know, this culture doesn't care about privacy, and it's not a human right. It's culturally specific. And maybe we could even extend that to what you were saying, that there's certain sub-communities within society that might have certain common concerns that are at odds with the majority community surrounding. So I actually think here contextual integrity offers you something powerful, because what it's saying is that we have social context and we have privacy rules that connect to the functions of and the values that construe the context, but that in fact different cultures organize societies in different ways. The relationships are different. We can think about societies that have clans and clan loyalty versus in the United States, where we tend to be quite nuclear family oriented. And so say social democratic countries like Sweden, you know, they're always the obvious case. They say, oh, Sweden, they don't care about because they just list everybody's earnings. So the argument, you know, the rebuttal, I don't know if it's a rebuttal, but if the explanation can still be systematic, we can say that this is work that I wish other, you know, this is work for anthropologists. This is not work I'm capable of really carrying out rigorously. It's to look at different cultures or different groups within and look at the principles and values that they subscribe to and say, what is the connection between their commitments, the values they subscribe to, and what the rules of engagement are? Because I'm going to use the word irrational. It's not that there's no connection between the two, but once you make a certain kind of societal commitment, then the rules might be different. So if my aunt will ask me who's the latest in my love life, maybe in a nuclear family environment, you might just say, ah, you know, none of your business, or wow, you're nosy. But if an aunt in a more clan environment, they would expect that information. So that doesn't mean they feel differently about privacy. It means that the rules adhere to the contextual arrangement. And maybe that's the case about these more particular communities in the U.S. Why we're not getting proposals, I don't know.
Okay, Rita?
Actually, I have other two proposals dealing with technology. But I just wanted to make a comment, not a question. There's an award-winning play that's playing right now at Arena Stage called Disgrace. that have been around for a while, I imagine New York and Mazzup. And as you were talking, I kept thinking of that play. So for those of you that haven't seen it, I recommend it. It's a really related.
Yeah, Sarah, were there any questions on that? Okay, so I've got another round of applause for our distinguished lecturer. Thank you. Thank you so much.